So for this evening's talk, again, just coming in, being very busy, not knowing what you're going to speak about, but having the confidence that whatever subject someone asks me to speak about, you can always make something interesting out of that subject. And just before coming in here, someone asked me that question that they were discussing about what is truth. And of course that is one of the biggest religious, spiritual, philosophical questions. But it's not just something intellectual, it is something which is important to each one of us. And so for this evening's talk, it will be, what is truth? Now the first thing to say about truth is everyone thinks that what they understand and believe is the truth. But then, there's so many people in this world, and so many people feel that they've got the truth, and that's the reason why we have so many arguments in this world. Or everyone thinks that they're right, and if everyone is right, or if you're right, then people who disagree with you must be wrong. And that has been the cause of so much arguments in the family, and so much trouble in the community, and even wars between countries, just fighting over who's right. And that really misunderstands what the nature of truth really is. One of the first things you should know about truth, if it's going to cause a fight, it can't be true. Truth has to be something which leads to harmony, which leads to peace, which settles you down. And that's an important point there. So if ever you argue with someone and make them angry, then you are wrong. No matter what you say. And what it means here, I think, hopefully you'll get this at the end of this talk, that truth is not a thing, it's not a goal, but truth is a process. Truth is not a set of ideas which you can put out there and say this is the final truth, as if it was some saying in a book or a Bible or written in stone. But truth is the way you look at that stone, the way you read that Bible, the way you understand those teachings of the Buddha. It's in the way rather than the goal that we find real truth in life. Because like many of you, I always sought for truth and sought for something solid, something final, which once I found the truth, which means that I could tell it to everybody else and convince them that I was right and everyone else was wrong. And certainly we call that like spiritual conceit. And of course you've always come across some people, and you know, unfortunately it may even be you, who argue so much that they know they're right, they've understood it, they've worked out all of the details of the truth, and they go around creating, you know, a pain in the neck. They are a pain in the neck because they go around telling one else what's true. And there's something wrong there. I always was very upset with, you know, evangelists, and they're not just Christian evangelists. Now there were political evangelists, and there's certainly some Buddhist evangelists as well. People who go knocking on your door telling you what is truth, and what is right and what is wrong. And there's something which is very grating about that. Sometimes people meet you at the street. Even about a few months ago, I was just walking down Hay Street, just going to the, this is some months ago, in the old immigration office, which was, you know, above Myers' store. And there, just on the way back to the car park, being accosted by a Scientologist, do you need a personality test? I think you need a personality test. So they're going to teach me about myself. And I said, you must be joking. I've been meditating for the last 40 years. If I don't know myself, you're not going to find it. So anyway, you get all these people who try to sort of think they're right and try to convert you and trying to do all this sort of stuff. But there's something wrong there. Even trying to convert someone, trying to change something, say, I know the truth, you don't, and here it is. Now, of course, that those sorts of evangelists, I think many people come to a center like this because they're really fed up with such evangelists. But of course, there's evangelists, not just religious evangelists. There's all sorts of other evangelists who are sure that they are right and you are wrong, and causing all sorts of arguments. And let's go to your real life, in your family, in your office. How many times has it happened? that you give advice and it's not received because the other person thinks they're right. And sometimes they're wrong. Sometimes your advice was wrong, but we always think it's right. Even just this morning, just going, this was in Malaysia, yesterday, the person taking me from Terengganu down to Kuantan, they were sure they got the right route. And the girl in the back was sure she had the right route. You know what happened, the girls are always right. And the boy was wrong, but he wouldn't admit it. So why is it that we are so attached to being right? And think that that's the truth, and that causes so many arguments in this world. Hopefully, that when I get into this talk, you'll understand what we mean by the truth. And that can also not just help you in your spiritual search for truth and meaning, but also help you have more harmony in your home as well. So you tend not to argue, because the direction, which way to go or not to go, that doesn't matter, that's got nothing to do with the truth. What has got to do with the truth is how you find out. The truth is the way, not the destination. Because when I was in, I think this was in Kuala Lumpur, giving a talk, somebody asked me, just an old question, but it's a very interesting question, what is the Buddhist idea of God? Can you please explain that? Now, talking about this in a Muslim country, so you've got to be very careful. But it's not just for the sake of being careful, not offending anybody. I wanted to actually not offend truth or not offend reason more than any person. So what is a Buddhist idea of a God? Straight away you don't just start saying what's in books or what other people say. You want to take this question to a much deeper level. And the answer which I gave was using a conversation which I had with an old friend who's unfortunately passed away, the abbot of the New Norcia Monastery, the Benedictine abbot, Abbot Placid, who I got to know very well over many, many years, and we had some great conversations together. And I respected him. He was honest, he was truthful, he was open, and he wasn't fixed, he could listen to some weird ideas which I had. I remember once asking him, because if you've ever been to that town of New Norcia, their abbey is a very, very old and ancient place, and we were allowed to walk around, he shows us everything, because we're fellow monks. And I once asked him, in this ancient building, one of the oldest buildings in Western Australia, are there any ghosts? Because I've always been interested in ghosts. I love ghosts. They're fascinating. And he says straight away, no, 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 sort of Catholics don't believe in ghosts. I said, is that true? You don't believe in ghosts? Yeah, we don't believe in ghosts, he replied. So what about the Holy Ghost? got you. So he was cheeky with me, I was cheeky with him. We had this great relationship together. But I remember once when he was being serious, now he said that one of his fundamental beliefs, now not what he got from some book or some lecture in some seminary somewhere, but something which he had got from his observations of life and working with many people, not just of Christians, but Buddhists and non-believers and everybody, one of his fundamental beliefs, and this is his words, that everybody was searching for God. And that's what he said. And I use that to get a Buddhist understanding of what God is. Because I respected him. Truth is respecting other people. And I said, well, from that statement, what are you all searching for here? In my early years as a monk, what was I searching for? And of course, I looked at my early lives as a monk. I was searching for peace. I was searching, you know, for real meaning of love. You know, to be able to also love myself, let alone learn how to love other people. Searching for meaning. But most importantly, I was searching for peace. And that's why I went to those forest monasteries. Where I left the busyness of the cities. Where you went to the deep caves where there was no sound at all. And you found in those deep caves where there was no sound at all, your mind was making more sound than anything else. You know, you'd always try and find caves where there was no bats, because the bats would shriek and shriek, but you find a cave with no bats, and then you find the bats were in your head. It's the bats between your ears, that's a problem. That's why when you go crazy in the English language, they say it's driving you batty. That's where it comes from. But when I was in those caves, I was searching for peace. And of course, you found the peace when you were bitten by mosquitoes. You found that peace when there was a big party in the village, you know, close by. Sometimes I found that peace when I had typhus fever. Sometimes you found that peace in the most unusual of places. But that's what I was searching for. And so, I remember having a conference, and I think Frank Brennan, I think he was the MC of this concert, or at least he was there, and he asked this question of me, you know, as a Buddhist monk, you know, what is your understanding of God? And I just quoted, and I said, look, if that's what Abbot Placid thinks God is, and it's what everyone is searching for, then the Buddhist idea of God is peace, is love, is meaning. And he said, because that's what most of you have come here searching for. Now when you put that idea in those terms, number one, you're not offending anybody. And number two, you're actually giving people a deeper understanding of some of these terms which people will fight wars over. And you're teaching this in a way which is answering their question without wars, and getting people into a deeper understanding of what truth really is and how it's found. So what I was doing there was an example of how truth is never found by contrasting your ideas with somebody else, by conflict. Conflict will never be the path to truth. It will always be the path to arguments, to distrust, and eventually to violence. It separates people. I always knew that truth had to be something which united people. It had to be. Because truth which divides cannot be truth. And straight away, that means all those evangelists, the people who divide and separate, the people who say, I'm a Buddhist, you're a Christian, therefore we can't have a cup of coffee together. That is not truth. It can't be truth. And as a Buddhist, I say, it is really wrong. You haven't understood what Buddhism is all about. But, if you understand truth, and it means you can be at peace with anybody, just about, you can have a wonderful cup of coffee with a Muslim, or you can just have a great afternoon with a Catholic, and you can enjoy each other's company, then you've got some understanding of what truth truly is. It's something which unites. Because instead of conflicting our opinions, we use the different ideas and views of every human being to find out that they must be right. How can we use their experience of life and my experience of life to get a truth which is common to everybody? Because a truth has to be common, otherwise it will never be able to unite. And of course, I'm working up to an old simile, but I did adapt that simile in Malaysia a few days ago. And it's a simile of the blind man and the elephant. Now, you've heard the blind man and the elephant story so many times, and you probably read it in the book. And because it was in Malaysia, I changed the simile to the, I think it was the five blind Malaysians and the kangaroo. Because I said these five blind Malaysians had heard of a kangaroo, but having never been to Australia, they didn't know what a kangaroo was. And so one day they decided to find out what a kangaroo was by feeling a kangaroo. And one person felt the tail, another one felt the paws, another one felt the head, and the other one felt the ears, and the last one felt the body. And the first blind man who felt the legs said, well, you know, I've never been to Australia, but I know that one of the things Australia is famous for, one of the artifacts which one of my aunties brought back when she visited, was a boomerang. And actually that's obviously what a kangaroo is. I felt the legs, it's two hairy boomerangs. If you've seen a kangaroo, you know, their legs are always at a right angle at the bottom. So that's what a kangaroo is a hairy boomerang. or the one who felt the head said, surprise, surprise, it's got two heads. Kangaroo's a monster. The two-headed Australian monster. And of course you know what I mean. The kangaroo is the only animal with two heads. One up here and one in its tummy. It's the joey. And another one said, no, a kangaroo, because they felt the body. It's like a teddy bear, because it's really soft and nice. And the one who sort of felt the claws, so it was a back scratcher. And the one who felt the head, you know, said it was just like a deer, but it had these two antennae on the top, keeping on moving around. And of course, the old story was that they argued what a kangaroo was. They contrasted their truths. And of course, that's what people do in life. I am right, you are wrong. And we argue. And the right way of dealing with this, so those five Malaysians, they sat together and they combined their understanding. And they found out a kangaroo is this teddy bear on two hairy boomerangs. Oh, I forgot about the tail, the snake at the back. And it's got two heads. And it's got, the top head has got these two, I forget what I called them, like two antennae, which move around. And they've got two back scratches on the front with claws. And of course that is a good description of a kangaroo. When we combine our understanding, actually that's where we can get better, deeper, closer to the truth. Oh, but I don't know if you know that story also, because I remember just going over to Hayman Island to teach at a leadership conference, and somebody mentioned the old story of the elephant and the seven blind men. And I just read another version of that story, which I mentioned at that particular conference. It was about the man and the seven blind elephants. I don't know if you've heard that story, but one day these seven blind elephants met together and they said they'd heard about this thing called a man. But they never met a man. So they wondered what a man was, and they realized the only way to find out was to find a man and to touch him so they can actually find out what a man was. So they all found a man each and they touched him with their feet. That's all they had to touch. And they all concluded that men were flat. You get the joke? The only way they can feel them is with their feet. So men were flat. They killed every one of them. But when we want to find out the truth, we have to sort of try and come together to add knowledge, to combine our truths. And that is the way we come much closer. So would it be a wonderful thing instead of at home when we have arguments? You know, instead of saying who's right and who's wrong, what do you believe and why? What is your version of the story and why? And find out some way of finding out, you know, what is underneath both of those ideas. Recently, when I checked her email just coming back here this afternoon, some lady had asked me, she'd listened to my teaching for a long time, and whenever I teach meditation, I say, just let it go, don't control anything, just make it peaceful and don't try too hard. But then she'd read a book by Ajahn Chah, which was paraphrasing one of the sayings of the Buddha, Nadamapada, that irrigators of paddy fields, they can channel the water, they can control it to go this way and that way. Water engineers can actually build a big dam, and by controlling the flow of the water they can prevent floods and have hydroelectricity. And so by controlling the mind you can harness it and you can sort of make it peaceful so you don't get upset, you don't get angry. And so she was saying, Ajahn Chah was saying, you should control. And Ajahn Brahm was saying, no, don't control, let go. What is wrong there? You can't both be right. And of course, instead of approaching what we sometimes look as conflict in the teachings, we actually try and bring those two teachings together. So it's not that one is right and one is wrong. How can we combine that? Just like the experience of an elephant. And what we obviously understand is But actually that letting go, which I keep on talking about, that is actually how we control the flow of our mind. An example of that, at the retreats I often give the simile of the water buffalo, because this was an experience when I was a young monk in Thailand. Every morning in the dry season, the people would take the water buffalo out in the fields to graze. And they would lead them off there, and the water buffalo were usually very placid animals most of the time, but every now and again they would get scared, they would get spooked, and they would try and run away. Now this man was leading his water buffalo out to the fields, and he was just passing our monastery when his water buffalo got very afraid and tried to run away. Now there was a string around the water buffalo's neck, and he was holding that string. And when the water buffalo tried to run away, he tried to control it by pulling it back, which is a very stupid thing to do. Because who's going to win? Who's the strongest? A human being or a water buffalo? The water buffalo won. It ran away. But the string had wound around the top of his finger, so the water buffalo ran away with half of his finger. He pulled the top of the finger off. And because this happened just outside our monastery, this poor man came in to our monastery with half a finger and blood all over his hand. So it wasn't a bad wound. We just took him, it's obviously very painful and very gory, but we took him to the hospital and he got patched up and he was fine afterwards. It was actually much easier to take the wax out of his ear with half a finger and the bone sticking out. It was actually fine in the end. It's always a positive side to whatever happens in life. But we always use that story afterwards about the power of letting go. Because if a water buffalo is about to run away, you don't try and control it. You let it go. And the water buffalo runs away only maybe 300, 400, 500 meters at most. And then the water buffalo stops. And then you can pull the water buffalo back once it's calmed down. And that's why sometimes, letting go is a form of control. And controlling is best done by letting go. You let the water buffalo go so it can settle down, and then you can pull it back. Now that's the same with your husband when he gets cranky. Don't try and control him, let him go. And when he's calmed down, then you can rein him in. Or like your children sometimes. There was, here in Perth, I forget who it was, they actually told me that when they were a young girl, 5 or 6 years of age, they had an argument with their mother. And the little 5-year-old girl said, "Mummy, I don't love you anymore, I'm leaving." And Mummy, being a good Buddhist, knowing just how to control by letting go, said, "Wonderful, darling, I'll help you pack your bags." So Mummy went into the bedroom with her child, and they packed her little suitcases and her favourite dolls, and before she left, Mummy said, "Hold on a minute, darling, I'll make you some sandwiches for your lunch." And there the little girl, having her bag of sandwiches and having a little suitcase, waved to Mummy, "Bye-bye, darling, have a wonderful life." As the 5-year-old left home. And the mother waited there waving her off. She didn't try and bring her back. She just said, "Bye-bye, darling." And the little girl walked down to the end of the path, opened the gate, and she started walking down the street. She didn't get to the end of the street, to the corner, when she started feeling homesick. She turned around and walked straight into the arms of her mother, who was still waiting by the door. "Welcome home, darling. Thank you, Mummy." That was brilliant psychology. That's how to control a 5 or 6-year-old by letting her go. And I remember telling that story to this professionally trained psychotherapist from Singapore who come to stay at my monastery for a while. And she, when I told her this story, she was actually rolling about laughing, being totally disrespectful, but she couldn't help herself because she said, I said, what the heck are you doing? She said, you wouldn't believe this, but I did the same when I was 6 years of age in Singapore. I was really upset at my mummy and I said, I'm leaving. Exactly the same thing happened. The only difference was in Singapore, the mother didn't have time to make a sandwich. She gave her $5 and asked her to get her own lunch. Those of you in Singapore could understand that. So with her suitcase and $5, and again, she didn't go to the end of the path. She was living in an apartment. She went into the elevator, to the lift. Her mother waved her off at the lift. As the lift doors closed, bye-bye, darling. Well, have a wonderful life. And of course, she just got down to the ground floor before she felt homesick. First the floor where she lived. Went straight back up again. And as the doors of the lift opened, there was Mummy. Welcome back, darling. Now that's how we control things a lot of the time. We let them go. And that's especially if someone is upset. Someone is upset, don't try to make them more upset by getting angry and upset back. That's no way to calm a water buffalo. And you may be someone who lives with a water buffalo. At least they've got a brain like a water buffalo. So you let them go. Let them vent, I think it's called. Let them say all this stuff. And once they've said all this stuff, you know, I say, that's what you've got 2 ears for. One to go in, one to go out. So remember, always have an ear which lets things out so you don't keep things in your brain. That's called letting go. So it goes in one ear, out the other. You've heard that before. That's why we've got 2 ears. And let them vent. Let them get angry. Let them rah, 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 rah. And then when they're calmed down, then you can rein them in and teach them some sense. Now you see from that, that's called truth. Because the truth is a process of causing harmony and peace in life. Truth is not an end, but it's a way. It's the road rather than the destination. That is what truth truly is. So, when I said about, you know, what is God, according to Buddhism, God is peace, is love, is kindness. See, these aren't things. This is just the way we live our lives. Peace is not something you attain. Peace is something which, the way you look at life. Peace is what you do with life. Peace is your attitude to life. It's not a thing. And that's why most philosophers hardly ever understand truth, because they look upon it as being something solid which they can put down and hold, rather than something which is a way of life, a way of looking, which is a wisdom part of the human being. So when we can understand it that way, we understand that why I said earlier that when we argue, just the argument, the conflict, that is not truth. All arguments miss the point. Because the point of truth, the truth is not a thing of being right because you know the most. Being right is being able to be the most harmonious, the most peaceful, the most loving. And a good example of that is I keep on talking about forgiveness in this center here. Every other week I talk about forgiveness. And people sometimes have a difficult to understand forgiveness and actually practice it. Because they always think, yes, she should forgive first, because she is wrong. So if she asks forgiveness of me, of course I'll forgive her. But you know, she should ask first. No, he should ask first. Who's right and who's wrong? Because sometimes we are both right. This is one of the terrible things with life. Everybody thinks they're right. It was Socrates who said that no one thinks they can think they're doing the wrong thing. Because everybody, what we do, we really think that we're doing the right thing. You've each one whatever you've done in life, you think there was a reason for that, there was a purpose for it, and that's why you did it. Like even saying Adolf Hitler probably thought he was doing the right thing. Now you may think that's a bit gross, but I know enough about the human mind. Even though he was totally deluded, totally mistaken, I thought, I really understand that he was thought he was doing the best thing for his country in the world. Totally deluded, totally wrong, but I think that's what he thought. Because I don't think anyone can do something knowing it is wrong. Really knowing it's wrong. You just can't do it. No one can actually have an idea and think it's wrong. Later on, they may understand that they were wrong. They did get it wrong in the past, but at the time, we all think we're right. Now that's the truth, the nature of the human being. And because we all think we're right, and sometimes we're deluded, and we don't know which one is deluded right now, that is why we should be much more accommodating to the way people think, and especially to what they say. Because we cannot be sure that this time it's me who's right. We can't be sure that this time it's me who's wrong. How many times have you been wrong? And at those times when you were wrong, at the time, you thought you were right. Correct? I think I'm right saying that. I could be wrong, but at the moment I think I'm right saying that. I think you get what I mean. Which is why that your idea, your opinion, your view, it's not worth arguing over, because you don't know whether it's right or whether it's wrong. That's what delusion actually is. One of these great sayings of Buddha about the delusion of human beings. We think we're right, and it turns out that we're wrong. And I'll give you an example of that. This was an old example which I used in this hall many, many, many years ago, just to show how easy it is for people to jump to conclusions. This was a time when in Thailand there were many scandals of monks with mistresses. Not just Buddhist monks in Thailand, but many other parts of the world. And it was in newspapers. And so one Friday evening, I decided it was time to make my own confession, to be truthful. And in front of everybody here, some of you may remember me saying this, I said, you remember in the newspapers, all these monks with mistresses, I want to confess, I want to open my heart in truth, to tell you that some years ago I spent some of the happiest hours of my life in the loving arms of another man's wife. I loved that woman, and she loved me, but she was married. We kissed, we hugged, had a wonderful time. Some of the people gasped. Oh no, not Ajahn Brahm too. Some of them almost left, were halfway out the door. Before I told them, it was true. Spent many hours in the loving arms of another man's wife. That woman was my mother. Another man's wife! It was my mother! We hugged, we kissed, had a wonderful time. Now, I said that story in particular that way because people, you get the evidence there, okay? Ajahn Brahm, hugging and kissing. I already set you up by saying scandals. Put that in your mind. So that was the framework which you're about to listen to that talk. Hugging and kissing in the loving arms of another man's wife. And you think, adultery. It's even worse than just having sex with sort of, you know, a mistress. This is adultery, someone else's wife. You did that specifically just to show how people can jump to conclusions and jump to truths which aren't real. Now, because I told you and explained to you just the reason that was my father's wife, and so I was a son, so it was okay, you know, it's allowable. But how many other times, just on so-called convincing evidence, have you convicted somebody? Your husband, your wife, even a friend. You cheated me. You didn't come on time. How many times do we take this idea that we know the truth and the other person is wrong? Story like that means I'm giving you more opportunity for doubt. Doubting your ideas. Maybe they're not so true. And that degree of doubt, understanding the nature, the way you come to conclusions, that is truth. Understanding the way we think, the way we get these ideas, and the way these ideas actually causes arguments. And because of that, because we never know when we are right and when we are wrong, that is why the most truthful and wise person is the one who asks forgiveness first. Doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong, because we never know that. But I know the one who is right is the one who says sorry first of all, and means it. I'm sorry because we didn't do the process correctly. I stood my ground and argued with you. I thought I was right. And who knows, maybe I was, maybe I wasn't, but I can't be sure. So I'm sorry, I argued with you. Now that is a holy, a virtuous, a beautiful action. And that's what I saw when I was a young monk in Thailand. I saw by example. It didn't matter who was right and who was wrong. The person who was praised the most was the person who could forgive, even though they didn't think they were wrong. Or they didn't realize, or didn't, were not sure they were wrong. They would still ask forgiveness first of all. Now you try that in your relationships. Doesn't matter, you know, who did the right thing or the wrong thing. There's been an argument. There's been conflict. So you ask forgiveness first of all, and then you are right. Right because you understand the process of life. So when we can understand truth that way, as the process of life, the way we look at life, the way we act and speak in life, then we understand why sometimes people who are just so full of themselves, always arguing, always saying they're right, that they have got no idea of what truth is. A truthful person, people who know the truth, they know how to relate to people. And of course they also know how to relate to life. They're not looking in truth like some absolute fact. They're looking at truth in a way of living and a way of life which actually does engender peace and love and meaning. The God of Buddhism, if you like. The thing which we really worship. So being right is not as important as being peaceful, or being kind, of being loving. The path is that truth. And that's exactly the same which we learn this in meditation. Enlightenment, how do you get, what is enlightenment? Look, it's the way. You're making peace, you're being kind, you're being gentle. There's three important ways of meditating. It's not even a way of meditating, that is meditation. Making peace, being kind, being gentle in every moment. That is the essence of meditation. And that's why everyone can meditate. You can always make peace, you can always be kind, you can always be gentle. You can always be truth that way. And so people who think, oh, I can make peace, be kind, be gentle, I can meditate, then I can find the truth. What do you mean finding the truth? That is the truth. There's an old Zen saying that once this person, this man, was about to cook his dinner. He had the wood, he had the pot, he had the rice and the water in that pot, but he needed a match, he needed a fire. So he went looking for a flame with a candle. Where's a flame? Where's this flame? I'm looking for a flame. If he only knew what fire was, he would have cooked his rice much quicker. If we only knew what truth was, then we can actually have some peace and happiness much earlier. But we go looking We go looking for truth, not knowing what truth is. Truth is the way you look, not what you see. And that's why that many of you, you may not know so much about philosophy, you may not have read all the teachings of the Buddha, you may not be learned, but intuitively, instinctively, you can recognize truth when it's right there. And when people actually do really forgive, when they really show their love towards one another, even though they're very different. You know, just when, for example, a Buddhist monk and a Christian abbot can crack jokes about ghosts and Holy Ghost together, we can have a great time together. There's something in that which is truth, which has real meaning in life. It's that love which a mother has to their child, so the Buddha said. It's that opening the door of your heart to someone else, no matter what they've done, no matter who they are. That unconditional part of love. Now that smells of truth. That feels truth. And that is truth. And that's why, you know, that's one of the most meaningful stories in that book I wrote. And that's such a powerful simile of someone saying to the other, whatever you are, no matter what you've done. And that's the most important part. No matter what you've done, no matter who you are, the door of my heart's totally open to you. Now that degree of unconditional acceptance, now that is another great definition of what truth is. And why is it truth? It's because it's a way of relating to life. It's a way of relating to life which brings peace and harmony in whatever you experience, even in death. Because people who don't understand truth sometimes look at the negative part of life, and sometimes that is nothing to do with truth. That is wrong. That is the antithesis of truth, evil if you like. Death is evil, sickness is bad. That can't be truth, because you're arguing with life. How many people I've known at the very end have fought with their death, have made a battle with their sickness, as if they've had a great argument with part of life. And when you make a battle with life, when you're arguing exactly the same as a husband and wife arguing who's right and who's wrong, is sickness wrong? Is death bad? If you don't know truth, yes, it is bad. If you understand truth, it's okay. It's one of the old little tricks in my public talks. When I ask people, is there anyone in this room who's never been sick? Please put your hands up if you haven't been sick. And no one ever puts their hands up. Each one of you from time to time has been sick. And in fact, if there was anyone in this room who hadn't had a sickness since they were born, you would be weird. You would be so strange that the doctors would take you into the hospitals and do experiments on you to try and find out why you're such a freak, you've never been sick. But if you have been sick, you're normal. So it's normal to be sick. It's usual to be sick. So why do we say, there's something wrong with me, I'm sick? Instead, I ask people who come here, when you go to your doctor, you know, when you're coughing, when you've sort of got a fever, to tell your doctor, doctor, there's something right with me. I'm sick again. Now that's truth, because sickness is part of life. Having a person who disagrees with you is part of life. Having a dog which barks is part of life. There's nothing wrong with dogs barking. There's nothing wrong with wives nagging. There's nothing. It's what they do. Ask other people's husbands. They all nag. That's what they do. There's nothing wrong with teenagers just, you know, being rebellious. That's what they do. There's nothing wrong with politicians lying. That's what they do. They don't really, but anyway. But there's nothing wrong with your body getting sick. That's what it does. So imagine just going to your doctor and saying, "Doctor, there's something right with me again. I've got cancer." Now that will take away a lot of pain. A lot of also guilt. That are how many people when they're sick get guilty about it? "And I've got heart problems. I shouldn't have been eating all those fish and chips." I've got no guilt at all. That's why I don't mind eating fish and chips. But don't be guilty about this. It's part of life, being sick from time to time. And it's part of life, dying. Look, everybody does it. So it must be right. So, can you open the door of your heart to sickness and death? And love it. And make peace with it. Then you understand what truth is. Truth is love. Making peace. Finding meaning in this thing we call existence in life. Because when we are with life rather than against it, when we combine, what has death got to teach me? What has sickness got to teach me? What has health got to teach me? We're just combining the different experiences of the elephant or the kangaroo to get this bigger picture. There's nothing which is wrong. There's no experience which we can't combine to get this bigger picture called life and understand it. We don't reject anything now. Because love, unconditional, the door of my heart is open to the whole of life. Even the stuff I found very difficult to bear. But that's life. Come in. I love you. And if you can be with that part of life, sickness and death, you can live with any partner. And they will sometimes I upset you, because you can be with them. This is one of the reasons why there's so many breakups of relationships, so many divorces and separations, because people don't know how to be with things. They only know how to be with things they like and find pleasant. But you won't find truth that way. Truth has to be able to open the door of your heart to all parts of life. Okay, so you try and make it nice, you try and make it better, but no matter how much you try and control, eventually you have to let that elephant, that water buffalo run away sometimes. You can't always control it, but you can always be with it. Now you understand what truth really is. So when people ask, you know, what is the truth in Buddhism? Sometimes people ask that, what's the holy book of Buddhism? And why the holy book, where they get all the truths listed out, 1, 2, 3. And sometimes people keep saying it's the Pali Canon, it's a Tripitaka, or you know, if you're a Mahayana, it might be sort of the Heart Sutra or the Lotus Sutra, or it's this saying or that saying. No, it's not in the books. The truth is never found in books. So the truth in Buddhism, the holy book of Buddhism, is meditation. It's learning how to experience and be with things. Learning how to be with life. And you don't learn how to be with life to find the truth. Being with life is the truth. Learning how to love a person who's difficult, that is the truth. Learning to have a child who's autistic and be with them, even though it drains all of your energy and you can't do things which you want to do, that is where you find truth. It's amazing just you find truth in so many unusual places. I've mentioned here, and I just was remembering what I said last night at a talk in Kuantan in East Malaysia, that one of my greatest teachers was not Ajahn Chah, not my father. Perhaps the best thing I ever learned at Cambridge University. All the theoretical physics, I've forgotten most of that now. But the thing which I never did forget was what I learned when every Thursday afternoon I went to spend the whole afternoon at Forborne Hospital just outside of Cambridge, just volunteering work with Down syndrome children. You know what it's like doing social work, doing volunteer work. You always think you're doing this to be a goody-goody, to try and give to these poor people. And I said, after a few weeks, you realize you weren't giving, you were receiving. They taught me truth, how to relate to a person so different than I was. That's what I thought at first. How to connect with a Down syndrome kid. And I was a snooty student, full of all my knowledge and skill at maths and theoretical physics. And these guys, you know, they couldn't even write. And you had to be with them. And I enjoyed being with them so much. And I often wonder why. And it's because they taught me, what I say these days is emotional language, emotional truth. How you don't argue with people on who's right and who's wrong. You just hug and smile and just be in each other's company. That truth of being in harmony with the other or with something different. That's where I value those times and realize there was a whole meditation retreats of insight which came from those experiences. So, I've been rambling for a while, but I think you get the meaning. What is truth? What is God? It's not some saying which you can write down, now I know the truth. It's not some concept which you learn, which you can use to argue with other people on who's right and who's wrong. Well, the truth is something far deeper, which has an effect of bringing peace to you and all around you, which really gives it that meaning, that inspiration, this, you really know it's right. And it brings harmony, which allows you to have love and peace with even people who are so difficult. And it's easy to love and be peaceful with them. And to be love and peaceful with your life. To find that truth, not in some concepts or words, but in the attitudes and ways you have of living in this moment, no matter what you have to experience. Being at peace with this, being at one with this, the union with the divine. And this, if you want, is that divine. Being at peace, letting go, being free. That is truth. So, hopefully, I've given you the answer today to what truth is. I'll find out if you understood it later on to see if you argue with other people tonight. To see if somebody cuts inside of you on the way out of here. And you are just so peaceful with that and happy. That's just what happens. To see if that truth, which you've understood, is the way you deal with life, you've really understood. Because truth is peace, and that's how you know it. Where peace lives, there you'll find truth. Where harmony dwells, there, underneath the surface, you'll find truth. Where you can open the door of your heart to even unpleasant experiences, you know that is the abode of truth. Thank you for listening.